From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Charges of voter suppression and related lawsuits got more attention than political platforms during Georgia's midterm elections, and some races are still not over. As the state heads into runoff elections next Tuesday, some voting rights advocates are worried that turnout for runoffs, especially among minorities, will be weak. Ari Berman is author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and he's on the line from New York City. Hello, Ari.
Good morning, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Also joining the conversation, Adrian Jones. She's assistant professor of political science at Morehouse. Hello, Adrian.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Ari, I'm going to start with you, though. We saw record-breaking numbers from midterm elections, high registration, energized voters, standing in line sometimes for hours. So turnout ahead of the early voting for, turnout is down 59% now in early voting for the runoffs. So why aren't as many people interested in these races?
Well, we're seeing a much different electorate in the runoff. We're seeing much lower turnout. We're seeing a much wider electorate, a much older electorate, a more Republican electorate, the kind of typical electorate we're used to in Georgia, as opposed to the electorate we saw in November with Stacey Abrams. And I think Abrams' candidacy brought a lot of new voters into the process. And Abrams said when she conceded that the Secretary of State race, which is one of the runoff races, was critically important for voting rights, because we saw what happened when Brian Kemp was in charge of enforcing Georgia's voting laws at the same time he was also running for election. And now there's an election to replace Kemp. And there's at least one candidate running, the Democrat John Barrow, who has very different views than Kemp. And so Abrams has encouraged people to vote in this runoff election, but it doesn't look so far like people are voting in large numbers. And there's always lower turnout in runoffs, so this is not entirely surprising. But I did think that turnout might be a little higher just because the Georgia Secretary of State office in general has been such a lightning rod. It seems like that would be something that a lot of Georgians would care about.
Well, so, Adrian, let's look at these races. You mentioned the Secretary of State's race. There's also Chuck Eaton, Republican candidate for Public Service Commissioner, his opponent, Democrat candidate Lindy Miller. Is it hard to get people excited about things like a public utilities commission?
I think it is. And I think people are less informed about what down-ticket candidates are doing, particularly something like Public Service Commissioner, which controls telecommunications and gas access in the state. People are not as familiar with that. And minority voters in particular are often motivated if they're mobilized, if there's a candidate in the race who sometimes is of color. With Stacey Abrams, in addition to being of color, she had a very strong ground game that matched her strategy to try to get Black voters out. So people felt mobilized, they felt motivated, and they felt empowered to be able to vote.
Do you think the new Fair Fight PAC and lawsuit announced by Stacey Abrams has more people interested in going to the polls even during the runoffs, or has apathy already set in?
I think it absolutely does. I think that voter suppression, while it prevents voters who want to vote from accessing the ballot at points, it also motivates people to get out. So ideally, people understand the importance now of the Secretary of State and how that matters to them as voters. And ultimately, because there are only two people on the ballot, if they're showing up to vote for Secretary of State, they're going to end up voting for Public Service Commissioner and perhaps become more informed about what some of the down-ticket races are.
Do you have a sense about how minority voters might vote in these particular races?
I'm assuming they're going to vote for the Democrats.
Right.
Minority voters tend to. John Barrows obviously is not as staunch an opponent of voter suppression tactics as Stacey Abrams was, but he's probably the candidate that minority voters will prefer as they are working in the next several years to reform voter access and voter mobilization in Georgia so that we can see what happens in 2020 and 2021.
Well, let's get into that a little bit, the minority vote and who are the voters. But first, Ari, this week, Republican Cindy Hyde-Smith won the closely watched special election runoff for Mississippi Senate, U.S. Senator, in Mississippi. Neither she nor Democrat Mike Espy won a majority on Election Day. Smith made a disdainful comment about public hangings, which is especially offensive to African Americans. Do you think it pushed people to get out and vote?
I do. I don't think this runoff election in Mississippi would have gotten any attention had it not been for some of the crazy things that the Republican candidate was saying. She joked that she'd be the first person to attend a public hanging. This is in a state with a long history of lynchings. She joked about that maybe suppressing the votes of college students was a good idea. It was revealed that she attended an all-white segregation academy for school. It was revealed that she had taken lots of pictures with Confederate people in Confederate history. It felt like she was running a throwback campaign, the kind of campaigns where we were used to seeing in Mississippi in the 50s and the 60s, but we hope that we had not seen anymore in the civil rights era. And so I think that motivated black voters to turn out. I think Mike Espy, the Democrat, ran a good campaign. Even though he lost, it was a much closer election than in years past. And so, I mean, there's kind of two ways of looking at the elections in Mississippi and Georgia. One way is saying, well, the Republicans won. But the other way of looking at it is that Mike Espy did much better than most Democrats had done in Mississippi, and Stacey Abrams did much better than most Democrats had done in Georgia. And that shows that these places can be competitive, and that when there is higher turnout, that these states are not as solidly Republican as they might initially seem.
Well, poll watchers did say Hillary Clinton couldn't hold on to President Obama's voters back in 2016. Now, here having Stacey Abrams on the ballot in Georgia appeared to drive turnout among likely Democrats and minority voters. This is Erin Wack. She covers race and voting for the AP, speaking with us on the program about that key demographic.
We know that when we are talking about voters and black voters, what we are really talking about is black women who tend to be kind of the most loyal and consistent voting bloc of the Democratic Party. And, you know, black women, when they vote, they don't just go to the polls alone. You know, they are taking their immediate family members. They are calling, you know, their network of friends.
Well, do you think, Adrian, that Democrats are depending too much on black women, that too much rides on them in terms of the vote?
I guess that's a possibility, but I am confident that black women really are the base of, at least for black voters, and potentially for minority voters in general. But black women are a strong voting bloc. I don't think they mind doing it. I think that more appreciation could be paid. I also think it would be fantastic if candidates would recognize that fact and really reach out to black women voters if they are really interested in winning elections and making sure that an important portion of their base gets out to vote.
So they have been stalwart, but voter registration increased this year, aided by organizations like the League of Women Voters, Black Votes Matter, other community efforts. Are they able to maintain momentum in runoffs, these ground game organizations?
I don't necessarily think so. I've been a little concerned that Barrels didn't necessarily really run with the momentum that Stacey Abrams created. So it's a possibility that as a result of a decrease in momentum, even though we might see higher numbers than we ordinarily have, that it might not quite be enough. But I think that people are getting out to vote. They are motivated. And it's making a difference in this election, and I think it's going to have a strong impact on future elections.
Right, that's the prediction. Ari, what affects voter turnout rates in general, and for minorities in particular, especially in runoffs?
Well, I mean, first off, just the interest in the elections. If there are candidates that appeal to people, that's going to drive higher turnout. And we saw that with Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. We saw that with Stacey Abrams in 2018. When there are candidates that reflect these communities, people are more likely to turn out. What affects turnout also, though, at least in Georgia, were efforts to make it harder to vote. I mean, there were a lot of disputes over the election, whether people could register to vote, whether they were purged from the voting rolls, how long the lines were, whether absentee ballots were accepted. I mean, all of this affect voter turnout as well. I mean, there was record high voter turnout. There were also record high problems in terms of ballots being counted. There were an exponentially higher number of provisional ballots in November than there were even in the last presidential election, which is very, very surprising. The problem is when you have a runoff election, a lot of people feel like the election was over. They feel like once Stacey Abrams said she wasn't contesting the election results, that was it. And a lot of people didn't hear the second part of the message, which is there are still races going on. And that's why, in general, I'm just not crazy about runoffs in the big picture, because, I mean, you spend all this money holding an election, you have much, much lower turnout, and then a much smaller demographic of people, a much smaller pool of voters, is going to be deciding the ultimate winner. So I'm not really sure the system is working that well for Georgia and other states, and you're just going to look at the number of people that are going to vote in this election. It's going to be much, much lower than it was in November, and so it's hard to say that the candidate who wins is going to have as big of a mandate as they otherwise would have, given that such a smaller pool of voters are going to be choosing the candidate.
Well, that's an interesting point, too, that the given the number of super slim margins in several states across the country in this election, I've been reading about some reports, like from the Electoral Integrity Project, for example, other groups, urging some kind of reform. What kind of changes are you hearing about proposed in the circles that you keep an eye on?
Well, if you look at Georgia, Georgia ranked 49th in 2016 in wait times. I'm not sure what the category will be in 2018, but it's going to be near the bottom. So Georgia had an incredibly confusing registration process. The exact match problem was huge, where people had registrations blocked because of tiny errors or possibly errors by the people that imputed the data. You had people purged at record rates. We don't know how many were legitimately purged and how many were wrongly purged. You had counties with too few voters. Voting machines, you had counties that ran out of ballots, you had the state voting on electronic machines with no paper backups, you had the Secretary of State running for office while overseeing his own election. All of this violates best practices. So I think people would like to see a smoother registration system, more clarity in when people are removed from the voting rolls, voting machines that have paper backups so people have faith in the results, the Secretary of State not oversee his or her own election when they're running for office. All of these are really basic things that a lot of other states do, but Georgia is failing. And I think this is really important because Georgia's going to have more competitive elections in the future. Georgia is a swing state now. We know that. In 2020, it will be targeted. And if we see these problems again, it's going to be very unfortunate for voters. So I hope whoever is elected will make this a priority. But I certainly think that if you look at the parties, one party and one candidate in the Secretary of State race is talking about these problems a lot more than the other.
Well, statistically, those accusations of voter suppression did affect minorities much more in those tactics. So, Adrian, you're working on a book that focuses on the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We just have a minute left, but how quickly does that historical context influence the way that we think, the perception there of elections today?
I think we think that there is more electoral protection than there is. As a result of the Shelby versus Holder decision in 2013, the Voting Rights Act was significantly weakened. So things like exact match law that wouldn't have become policy if Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was still active are interrupting elections. And I think that over the next several years, at least in Georgia, we really need to work on strengthening the system, as Ari is suggesting, so that wait times are lower, things go more smoothly, and perhaps think about having closer runoffs or rank voting runoffs so that the same group of people who are motivated to be at the election in the first place are able to make the decision overall.
Adrian Jones, she's assistant political science professor at Morehouse College and author and political researcher. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Ari Berman is also with us on the line. Thank you, Ari, very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Today is the last day for early voting. The runoff election takes place on Tuesday, December 4th. We will, of course, keep you posted here in GPB. We'd love to hear from you. How can we increase voter turnout for runoffs? Let us know at OST Talk. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it is a huge moment for Georgia sports. After last night's game, Atlanta United is heading to the MLS Cup Final on December 8th.
There is the final whistle. All right, Atlanta, we're coming to you. We'll see you next Saturday night for MLS Cup 2018.
Well, we have got the in-house crowd with us today. GPB reporter Ross Terrell and producer Taylor Gant are with us to give us the latest on both football, American, and global style. Welcome, both of you.
How's it going?
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Taylor, I'm going to start with you. The Five Stripes lost to the New York Red Bulls in the Eastern Conference final second leg, but the team still secured its spot in the MLS Cup. So can you explain how a losing in a game results in a winning spot in the finals?
Yeah, oftentimes those two things don't go together that well, do they?
Yeah.
Well, the way it works in the at least in the last two rounds of the MLS playoffs before the championship game is you have home and home series. So each team gets a home game. And then when the series is over, you tabulate the goals. You get a few extra extra credits if you score on the road. But Atlanta had a 3-0 win at Mercedes-Benz Stadium in front of a full house. So they really put a lot of pressure on the Red Bulls to have to go home and have an enormous scoring game if they even wanted to stay close. So it was a 1-0 loss, but they would have had to give up 3 goals at least to even tie the series again. So Atlanta moves on, and they're going to host the big game this coming, not this coming Saturday, but the Saturday after.
So they basically just had to play defense.
They did. It was not a very pretty game. When you watch Atlanta United games, you're usually used to seeing a lot of flowing play and, you know, a lot of energy from a side that has a lot of scoring potential. But this was just kind of like it was in the muck. It was a game that was based very much on defense, and you know, they knew the result they had to get, so it wasn't going to be anything flashy. It was going to be a lot more workmanlike.
Taylor, the Atlanta United had never beat the New York Red Bulls until this past Sunday, that game, the first home of the home-home series.
Indeed.
That you mentioned. That's when they shut them out 3-0 at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Mm-hmm. In the first leg of the conference final. So can you talk us through how they managed to best New York and move ahead?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, all season New York and Atlanta were going head-to-head to see who would have the best record of the year and win the Supporters' Shield, which means you get home field advantage throughout the playoffs. Atlanta lost out on that, so it seemed that New York would still maybe the better side going into the playoffs. But Atlanta really just turned it on. They got a lot of support from their bench. They were leading 2-0 in the game, and then they got a score from Tito Villalba off the bench to basically make the hill that New York had to climb that much higher. Instead of just scoring twice, they had to score 3 times. And, you know, I think Atlanta's only lost 3 times inside their home building. You know, a couple of them have been to New York. But they really use the home field advantage to the highest degree that they possibly could, and they kind of shook off the boogeyman. Their first ever loss was to New York at Bobby Dodd Stadium, so it was nice to finally have that demon exercised, if you will.
A little resolution. It is hard to believe that the success of Atlanta United has pulled off in just 2 years. True on the field, yeah, and in the stands, with record attendance and financial stability. Here is midfielder Jeff Lorenowitz speaking to Fox Sports last night.
What it means to the city of Atlanta, what it means to the people that put this club together, what it means to the guys that came from far away from home to come and play here, our coach, it's all those things. I'm just one guy on the team, but it's really a team effort. It's a citywide effort, to be honest, and we're coming home.
We're coming home. How did Atlanta United manage to win the hearts of Atlanta so quickly? I mean, is it just that people love to cheer for a winner, or is there a real cultural shift towards soccer going on?
We were talking about this with your next guest in the room over here, Josh, who said you'd like to talk a little bit about Atlanta United too, not just music, but he might stick with his segment. But, you know, it can be any number of things. It's the incredible cultural diversity of this city. It's the incredible amount of transplants we have here who have never really had a soccer team to root for. You know, I was talking to a guy on MARTA who is completely head-to-toe in Atlanta United gear. And I said, oh, how long have you been a soccer fan? He's like, this season? You know, I just saw the excitement. I wanted to get in on it. And I think that's really, you know, that's really carried over to where people who are, you know, traditionally maybe not sports fans or even soccer fans, they go to a game, they really experience the atmosphere, and it's something very wholly unique to any other thing in sports. It's kind of its own little niche right now that it's got so much attention and so much excitement around it.
How about for you, Ross? You're representing here for the traditional American football. Are you a convert to Atlanta United?
I'm not. I have a hat, and that's about it.
You don't
it.
Have the whole gear.
No, not at all. Not at all. I'm still a traditional football guy. I mean, soccer's great. They had the sellout crowds, the All-Star game, championship game coming, and we haven't had a champion here in Atlanta since, what, the
95.
90s. Braves did it. So, but I will leave soccer to the rest of the
city.
Okay,
all right. You get your time in just a minute. But, Taylor, let's look to the future. Soccer, the world's most popular sport, not as prominent, of course, in the U.S., and we don't usually have the best coaches and players. Atlanta United managed to buck that trend and secure some real phenoms.
That's right.
But head coach Tata Martino is leaving next year to coach the Mexican national team, and people are wondering whether Martinez will stay, for example. He set the record for goals during an MLS season. Can Atlanta United sustain this kind of success without Tata?
Well, it's going to be difficult. I mean, the whole concept behind Atlanta United was different from what a lot of new soccer teams do. So instead of bringing in maybe one of the really established stars, do you think what LA did with David Beckham, a name that everybody knows, it's very flashy, they decided to hedge their bets on young players who hadn't played their best soccer yet, but their potential was very, very high. And it helped having Tata Martino, who's, you know, a very big name, South Central America, you know, with his work for the Argentinian national team. to lure some of those players in and to sell them on the idea of playing in a place that had, you know, very little soccer record to speak of. It's going to be tough. Hopefully they'll be able to find somebody to fill that void. Miguel Almiron, who's one of the most popular players, is basically confirmed to be gone. He's probably going to end up playing in England. There's a couple of teams bidding very heavily to get his services next year. So it's going to be interesting, you know, especially after you win a championship. You know, it's always interesting to see potentially if they do, you know, how a team rebounds after kind of having reached the pinnacle. How do you sustain that?
All right. Ross, we're getting to you. Who are you pulling for in Saturday's SEC championship game? I'm not asking you. I'm asking the audience. I'm talking about the Georgia-Alabama rematch with GPB's Ross Terrell and Taylor Cant. So you can let us know where your loyalties lie on Twitter. We're at OST Talk, or we're in our Facebook group. You can let us know or leave us a voice message. We're at 404-500-9457. Well, of course, tomorrow, the 2018 SEC Championship game at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. First time Georgia and Atlanta have played each other since January, when the Crimson Tide beat the Bulldogs in the national championship match. Alabama's fifth national win since 2009, all under coach Nick Saban. And Ross Terrell, you were there.
Yes. Before the game started, President Trump took the spotlight. He was greeted by protesters outside the stadium, including Isabel Hidalgo.
Basically, we don't want him to think he can just come here without anybody saying, we don't like you, we want you impeached, you're nuts, get out of our town.
Inside, he stood on the field for the national anthem, where he was met with applause and boos. But then it was time for the main event, the national championship game. It was a raucous crowd as the game began. And Georgia jumped out to a 13-0 lead at halftime. Defensive player of the game, Deron Payne, says something changed in the Alabama locker room at half.
I think we went in and Coach Saban told us we needed to tighten things up, and I guess the team heard Coach, and we came out and tried to play our best ball.
In the third quarter, Alabama head coach Nick Saban rolled the dice and came up big. He benched their starting quarterback for a true freshman, Tua Tagovailoa.
I thought Tua would give us a better chance and a spark, which he certainly did.
Tagovailoa led the Crimson Tide to their first touchdown of the game about 6 minutes into the third quarter. UGA responded with a touchdown of their own, but Alabama scored the next 13 points of the game to tie it at 20 apiece. They missed the field goal that would have won it in regulation, but instead finished the job in overtime. Tua threw a game-winning 41-yard touchdown pass to fellow freshman Devontae Smith.
I looked back out and he was wide open, so I hit him, and you know, here we are now, thank God.
It was the freshman that helped win it all. That turned out to be the play and the story of the game. Alabama coach Nick Saban says he can't remember a time when they had to rely on so many young players to win a matchup.
A lot of those guys are really mature for their age, and they were ready to make contribution. And they certainly did a fantastic job for us this year. There's no doubt about that.
With the win, Saban remains undefeated against former assistant coaches. He's now 12-0. This time, he knocked off Georgia head coach Kirby Smart, who worked with Saban for 9 years at Alabama. The Crimson Tide claimed their 17th national title. For NPR News, I'm Ross Terrell in Atlanta.
There are people in our newsroom that get a little PTSD from even hearing that, Ross. But thank you for filing that for the network. SEC championship game, we're going to see those two teams from the national championship, Georgia and Alabama, meet for the first time since January. So how's Georgia's season been going?
Georgia's season's been going well. They're 11-1. Their only loss was to LSU, but their defense is what really sticks out. Jake Fromm is back, who played in that national championship game, and this really looks like a team who was on a revenge tour to get back to this exact moment, and they have their opponent in Alabama.
So we heard a little from last year's game. Taylor, you were also at the national championship game when Alabama came back to beat Georgia 26-23 in overtime. How has Alabama been doing?
Well, they haven't lost since, so the juggernaut season continues. There's a lot of basically there is a I think a two touchdown spread right now as far as UGA being an underdog in this game, and the team's only improved since that moment when they won in overtime against UGA. Tua Tagovailoa has only gotten better as a passer. The defense is still as stout as it always is, and they've been winning their games I think by an average of around 20 points or so, or the team hasn't even gotten that close to them. So it's a bit of a long shot for UGA this time. Is if you know if history indicates anything, though, it's going to be a close game. I don't think it's going to be a blowout one way or the other.
So, who are the other players to watch in this rematch besides Tua? What do you think, Ross?
You have DeAndre Swift and Elijah Holyfield, two of running backs from UGA who look a lot like Nick Chubb and Sonny Michel from last year. Mm. And then Alabama has a 1,000-yard receiver who you have to contend with. I think Alabama is a picture of dominance, though. And there have been games this year where we thought when they played LSU, oh, it's not going to be a blowout, and they somehow just keep winning. And I expect that to happen again on Saturday.
What could make Georgia win, do you think?
If God's on their side. No, they would have to come out and play near perfect football, and they would need turnovers and need mistakes from Alabama. But, I mean, this team, they might be able to beat some NFL teams. They're that good.
Yeah, I think if there's any chance, you can't have Jake Fromm, who's the quarterback for the Bulldogs, trying to throw the ball all over the place, because the defense is just too good. You can't beat them just one way. You have to mix things up. So, like Ross said, it's going to take basically a near flawless offensive performance to stick around with Alabama.
So the 2019 National College Football Championship is going to be played in the Bay Area. How will the results of this SEC Championship figure into which team goes to the national championship? How does that work?
Ross, would you take it away?
Yeah, this will have direct impact. So right now you have the top four teams get into a playoff, and those four teams have a chance to play for the national championship. Alabama right now is number one. Georgia's number four. If Alabama wins this game, they're in, no doubt. It gets tricky because if Georgia wins this game, you could possibly see these two teams each get in. Each of them will have one loss, and nobody is going to say Alabama's not one of the best four right now.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, there was a funny plot twist earlier this year when the University of Central Florida declared itself national champion. That was because it had gone undefeated all season. Now, here's a skit. This was passed around online. Alabama fan and a Georgia fan reacting to this bogus story that Central Florida had canceled the championship game.
What? How can they do that?
Well, they're undefeated and you're not.
But we beat the number one team in the nation in the semis. And we just clobbered a current Heisman winner and beat five top 25 teams.
They beat a 3-9 UConn on the road and won the Peach Bowl.
You're joking, right? This is a joke.
They've already scheduled their championship parade. I'm sorry, boys, but it's over.
Sad music. Ain't over yet. The NCAA recognized UCF as national champion alongside Alabama. How does this mean any team can just declare itself winner?
That seemed a bit more of a PR move than anything else. We always have these conversations. We've had them for years as far as, smaller schools who have these really good seasons. Should they be a part of these? We've just had the tournaments only a few years old, but a little while back in the early to mid-2000s, Boise State was the team that was obviously in Idaho, very small school playing, against other small schools, but they always had these great seasons and they were always clamoring to be a part of the championship picture. But I think you're always going to have these debates, as long as the playoff system continues, that the small guys should get a chance too. But it's tough, especially when, they don't get a chance to showcase their abilities on a national stage like the other teams do.
Well, since I moved to the South, I've been told that the SEC championship is the real national championship. Alabama, Georgia, both SEC teams, they went to the nationals early this year. What do you make of that?
That used to be the rhetoric. That's why we got to the system, is because we had SEC teams essentially playing each other in the national championship, much like last year. But you have a number of other teams who, Oklahoma's, the Ohio State's, even the Michigans, the Notre Dames, Clemson's, who would say, no, wait a minute, you still have to go through us. And those teams are pretty well. Clemson won the championship 2 years ago. Ohio State won the first ever championship in this format. So I wouldn't quite give that title solely to that.
Sounds like a jaded Ohio State fan over there.
Okay, so have you all heard of the NFL? It's this thing that's out there.
The real football?
The real football. How are Atlanta Falcons been doing?
Not good. Not good. They're currently on a 3-game losing streak. They're 4-7. Mathematically, could they get into the playoffs? Yes. Realistically, not a chance. They can't win their division. They were eliminated when they lost to the Saints. They lost to Cleveland. They lost to Dallas. This team should probably start looking ahead to the draft and preparing for next season.
All right. Any midseason picks then for the Super Bowl? It's only a little over 2 months away now.
I think you have to keep putting money on the Patriots until Tom Brady calls it quits. He's still, the most accomplished quarterback in league history at this point. So I think you got to keep going with him.
Ross,
Yeah, I will say there is, I don't know if you guys know, a Super Bowl curse. No host city, their team has never won a Super Bowl.
Right.
So I guess we knew coming into this a couple years ago the Falcons weren't going to make it. people want to say the Chiefs, the Rams, Saints, Patriots. Don't rule out the Chargers and the Bears just yet. My dark horse is the Chicago Bears.
Interesting.
Okay. Yes, I really understand and agree everything you're talking about. GPB reporter Ross Terrell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And our GPB Morning Edition producer, Taylor Gant, thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In honor of tomorrow's SEC championship, we've got some Redcoats marching band music to play us out until we hear the best albums of 2018 from Paste editor Josh Jackson. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Paste magazine just released its list of the top 50 albums of the year. New albums from Nico Case, Courtney Barnett, and Janelle Monáe made the list. Josh Jackson is editor of Paste Magazine. Welcome, as always, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you with us. And you can tweet us your picks for the best album of 2018. We are at OST Talk on Twitter. You can also post them on our Facebook group. So let's talk about compiling this list first, Josh. Do you have clear favorites from the year? I mean, did some sneak up on you?
I'm always surprised because, you know, the way we do this, we have our staff, our writers, even our interns all vote for their top 20s, and it's a pretty democratic system. So, you know, we want this to be a music discovery platform for all of our readers. It's also, you know, for me, every year there's something that I just missed and find on these lists.
So no voter suppression accusations on this list.
not on this one.
Now, we are saying album. Is the album still a thing in the age of the Spotify playlist or the Pandora playlist?
I think it is. I mean, this is how a lot of artists are still releasing their music. You know, they're still putting the thought into packaging these songs together and making an album. And that's kind of what we're celebrating here.
What kind of things are you looking for in the best album of the year? Does it have to define the cultural moment or the musical moment or political statements or just really great music?
Just really great music. I mean, for us, you know, when you're looking at something like a piece of art, It's all in the eye of the beholder. So if you like it, then it's good enough and give it your vote and we'll see where it lands.
Do you find that in, you know, I'm looking at some of the titles here. It didn't make me feel completely past it because I recognize some names, Elvis Costello, Nico Case, Superchunk, Decemberists, Roseanne Cash. But there is quite a range here, right? Do you find that your interns and your young editors have a different perspective and towards new music?
Yeah, I mean, there's some debut albums here, along with legends like Elvis Costello, and the stylistically it ranges. You know, we do a lot of indie rock, a lot of singer songwriters, but there's also hip hop on here like Pusha T and No Name. There's country albums from Kacey Musgraves and Ashley McBride. It kind of runs the gamut.
Janelle Monáe's third album, Dirty Computer, was also one of her most personal, and that was on your list. In April, she came out as pansexual. This was in an interview with Rolling Stone, and her early work definitely dealt with ideas about gender and sexuality, but this was the first time that subtext made it into text. What was special about this album when you listened to it?
Well, Janelle Monáe, I got to spend a whole day with her back in 2009 interviewing her for a pilot, TV pilot that we'd made. And back then I was like, she's a superstar. I know she's going to be a superstar. And since her last album, she's gone on to do acting and really burgeoning career that way. But it's still got that sci-fi element. She put out a visual, almost like a short film to go along with this album. And it's still got all that sci-fi about which, you know, she uses sci-fi to deal with identity and sexuality and gender and all these things. And it's an amazing album.
She's just an amazingly creative person. Also, Big Red Machine's self-titled album made the cut. It's a side project by The National's Aaron Dessner and Bon Iver's Justin Vernon. Has a ton of guest vocalists and artists who make up the collective. Let's hear Lila from Big Red Machine's album. Heaven in a 1-2 set. Heaven in a more and more. Oh, So that's got a lot of beat to it, a lot of that kind of polyrhythmic stuff. Where's this all coming from?
Well, you know, this is one of the, I don't write a lot of our reviews, but this was an album I heard and I just said, oh, I have to write this one. So, you know, sometimes side projects like this can feel like a tossed off thing. This to me felt like the opposite, like this was remarkably ambitious. It's a labor of love that these two very popular musicians in their own right kind of came together with a bunch of their friends. And it just sounds like the way that they want to create art, and they got to do it exactly as they wanted to do it.
So we do have links to the full 50 best albums of 2018 from Paste Magazine at our website, but we also would love to hear from you. We're at OST Talk on Twitter if you want to tell us any particular picks for your favorite album of 2018. Josh Jackson, he is the editor of Paste, is with us. And Nico Case's Hell On, that's her seventh full-length solo album. Paste writer Ben Salmon described Case's voice as a fist looking for a fight. So what about it? What about it is surprising you all these years after her start?
Well, you know, and she's a longtime favorite of ours. I think most of her albums have probably ended up on our year-end list. But this is probably has some of the poppiest arrangements of her career. She played these songs here in Atlanta earlier this year when she came to town to be part of Chris Tilley's Live From Here at the Fox. And these are, again, just really adventurous songs compositionally. She structures the songs a little bit differently than anyone else. She's just her own kind of genre. I mean, the way that she writes music.
The Nico Case genre.
Yeah, yeah.
Another pick from Atlanta, or from the list, is Atlanta-based visual artist and musician Lonnie Holly Smith. I will say that Lonnie is a very close person to me, a very dear friend. Producer Richard Swift produced this tune called Copying the Rock.
Over many rocks. See, I don't know very much about all the other planets. I don't know nothing about Jupiter. I don't know Mars or Venus.
Holly kind of defies genre. How did this work expand what we expect from him musically?
Well, and this was a new discovery for me this year. I sort of had a high fidelity moment when I was in Wuxtry Records in Athens, and they started playing it over the speakers, and I was like, "What is this?" I didn't know that anybody could mash up Tom Waits and Sun Ra and give us something completely new. So, the producer, Richard Swift, he's also on our list with his own
the
album.
Hex.
He passed away this year. Just a devastating loss for a lot of people in the music world. And we keep getting these little gifts that we didn't know were coming, like on Lonnie Holly's album, or Lucius has a holiday song now that he produced. And that was a rough loss.
All right, let's go to your top three picks. We've got Courtney Barnett's Tell Me How You Really Feel, which comes in third. Here's Need a Little Time. Courtney Barnett there from her album Tell Me How You Really Feel, one of the picks for Paste's top 50 albums of the year. She played the Shaky Knees Festival in Atlanta, like many of the other artists on your list. What is it about this album? She's an Australian singer-songwriter. What stood out?
So she came on the scene just a few years back, and I went back and looked, and her last solo album was number 3 on our list in 2015. Last year, she was number 5 on our list with an album with Kurt Vile. She has these clever lyrics with these big melodic hooks, and can go from being this quiet singer-songwriter to sounding like Nirvana, and you know, from song to song.
Also, who played at Shaky Knees Parquet courts.
Yeah, one of our staffers played some of this music for their grandpa over Thanksgiving, and he said he described it as 60s rock and roll with punk rock vocals, and that's pretty much
his grandfather did.
Oh yeah, that was like that's exactly what that is.
His grandfather does not know mine. I'll say that much. This is a little bit from Parquet Courts' album Wide Awake, the title track. Okay, so this is definitely what they recorded it at Mardi Gras, was it? Or I saw the video that looked like it was at Mardi Gras.
Well, one neat little Atlanta connection here is that this was produced by Danger Mouse, Brian Burton, from here in the ATL.
So this is a little funky, a little groovy, definitely made for dancing. What made it the top two pick? Not quite the best album.
It was on so many people's lists. It's just such a fun record to listen to. You've got these Afro beat rhythms going sort of hand in hand with these almost stoner punk anthems. So
I think the grandfather's description was pretty darn good.
I think her grandfather got it, just nailed this one.
Maybe he's going to be on your list of pickers next year. And then there is Lucy Dacus, her second studio album. It's called Historian. Very personal, very political. She's only 23 years old. Here's Yours and Mine, which she wrote after the 2017 Women's March. Stay indoors. Take care of you now. Take care of you now. Me and mine. Me and mine. We got a long way to go before we get home. 'Cause this ain't my home anymore. This ain't my home. Lucy Dacus, the number one album according to Paste magazine. It's called Historian, that song, Yours and Mine. Do you remember, Josh, when you first heard the album and what stuck with you on that initial listen?
Well, you know, she came out with her debut album a year or two ago, and I loved that one. So I was really excited about this one coming around, but certainly avoided the sophomore slump here. What I love about Lucy is she's such a great lyricist. The songs just connect with you. But, you know, she could be singing about the phone book, you know, or singing the phone book. And the music is still just these majestic, sweeping songs. And, this was my personal favorite for the year, and that doesn't always happen that my personal favorite ends up on the top of the Paste list. So I was excited to see that I was not alone in voting for this one.
Well, let's see what's coming up for live shows. Elton John is going to be playing in Atlanta tomorrow. He said that he's retired from touring, so this is the farewell Yellow Brick Road tour. Last time to see him in concert. First of all, do we believe that?
Well, here's the thing. So he's playing tonight and tomorrow night, and it is the farewell tour, and it is sold out, but that doesn't mean it may be your last chance, because the tour is going to include 300 shows on 5 continents and doesn't end until 2021. So you still got time. Maybe not
farewell.
In Atlanta, but you've still got time somewhere to see him.
Well, he has influenced so many young artists. I'm thinking Lady Gaga, because she's got a terrific cover of Your Song. So it's funny because even people who didn't know Elton John, he's been around for, 50 years, may know him now from a commercial. He's done this commercial for some department store chain in the UK that has gone completely viral. It's kind of him aging backwards. How do you see his musical legacy playing out in the pop landscape today?
I think he is pretty universally beloved, no matter what genre you like. I mean, I think for there was a period of time where it might have seemed less cool, but I think it's hard to find somebody who's not an Elton John fan these days.
Leslie Odom Jr. of Hamilton fame is putting on a concert on the 5th with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, and he has a holiday album called Simply Christmas. Here's his little cover of Merry Christmas, Darling.
That I wish you Merry Christmas, Happy New Year too. I've just one wish this Christmas Eve. I wish I were with you.
All right, I'm going to admit I'm not the target demographic for Christmas music, but that's pretty sweet.
Well, I'll admit that I'm a huge Hamilton fan, and he'll always be Aaron Burr to me. But when you see him in concert, typically he's playing, you know, a bunch of standards like Nat King Cole and Cab Calloway, as well as, you know, the Wait For It and Dear Theodosia from Lin-Manuel Miranda's play. But
right.
Yeah, you're going to hear a lot of Christmas music on this particular tour.
Well, and especially with the Atlanta Symphony, that'll be beautiful, filled out sound. Rufus Wainwright is playing in Atlanta on December 12th. He's got a new single that he did release at the end of October, Sword of Damocles. He said it's an artistic response to what's happening in the American government, and he was urging folks then to vote. Has his music always had a strong political message?
Not this overtly, but that's always been part of just his DNA. And it's a musical family that is very political in what they're doing. It works for the symphony orchestra.
Yeah. We're sending you into your weekend in style with some songs that we've been enjoying this week, too. First, I'm going to start with my pick. I saw Jim White play at the Grocery on Tuesday. Do you know Jim White?
I do know Jim White, and I wish I'd known that was happening because I love Jim White.
It was such a special show. He's an artist and musician. He's gone through big bouts of depression, said he's mentally ill. He spent some time as a New York cab driver. Now, at the Grocery, he did his album Wrong Eye Jesus from top to bottom, and this song just keeps going through my head. It's called Still Waters.
Well, I was shipped up down in Mobile with a girl from New York City. She woke me up one night to tell me.
Jim White there, song that I can't get out of my head this week. How about for you, Josh? What are you listening to?
So for me, I wanted to pick this band Boy Genius because they put out an EP this year, and that didn't qualify for our best albums, but it's still the thing that I keep going back to. It's an indie supergroup with our top pick, Lucy Dacus, along with Phoebe Bridgers and Julian Baker. They're three of the most talented up-and-coming singer-songwriters, and it's just a wonderful EP.
Well, we are going to leave everybody with that song from the EP. It's called Me and My Dog. As we say goodbye to Josh Jackson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Even though we forgot to eat, and you had a bad.
That's Josh Jackson, editor of Pace Magazine, sending us into our weekend with some jams. Now, we do have a link to Pace list of 50 best albums of 2018 and their picks for live shows in the area. Those links are at gpb.org. Thanks, Josh.